This is Orson Welles speaking. I'm giving something away absolutely free, gratis, and for nothing. If you'll step a little closer, I'll tell you all about it. I may sound like a medicine show, but really I'm not going to sell you any snake oil. I've got a radio I'd like to give you. A fine Lear 5-tube table model. It's yours if you'll send me a letter I can use on this program. You don't need to cut off any box tops or mail me any coupons. This is neither a contest nor a commercial. The radio is yours if I can use your letter. We'll get to that in just a minute.
It is only 2 weeks since Lear Incorporated made the most sensational announcement that has yet come forth in the field of post-war home radios. It was the first word about Lear sound on tape, that newest development in recording that's several steps ahead, even of the wonderful wire recording you've been hearing about. At the touch of a switch, you make a record of children's songs, gay times, and broadcasts right from the air. Without a moment's delay, it can be played back for you to enjoy. It's yours to repeat thousands of times, yet any time you don't want to keep what you record, you clear it off the tape just by recording something else. This, plus the fact that tape costs less than wire, makes it inexpensive to build up a library of just the recordings you like best. So again, you see what we mean when we tell you that you always can expect whatever is newest and best from Lear. Your Lear dealer will be glad to show you all the advanced features of the new Lear radios. They are features you will want to have in your new radio. Remember, the name is Lear. L-E-A-R. And now back to Orson Welles.
Last week, after much travel and adventure, I reached New York. As the MC always says in the nightclub, it's good to be back. It always is. This being not merely the greatest of all the great cities, but one of the friendliest, too. I know. I've been broke in this town more than once, stone broke, and even hungry, and I can tell you right now that if there's such a thing in the world as a good city for a lonely man, New York is it. Since I was here last, the war is over. Yesterday there was a heart quickening parade of the 81st Airborne down Fifth Avenue to prove it. Peace, it's wonderful, says Father Divine, high up in Harlem. But he said that before. There are other indications. On Sixth Avenue, now called, for reasons best known to my fellow commentator, Mr. LaGuardia, the Avenue of the Americas, I saw a real sign of peace. A weary taxi wore it like a buttonniere. A gardenia in the lapel of a Bowery bum would be less surprising. The sign read, "I take fares for Brooklyn." As it happens, I'm a chronic sign reader. I don't approve of posters, but I can't resist them. I don't condone the ruination visited by paint and paper on this world we have to look at where every prospect advertises, but I haven't learned to look the other way, or rather I haven't found where to look. The urgent propaganda of popular merchandise spreads with the poisonous gaiety of the multiplying toadstool from marketplace to farmland. The ad man is a voice crying in the wilderness, and you will have to fly far and by jet propulsion to find that sanctified subdivision of the skies where the adventuring aeroplane is not blazoning forth the wonders of a mouthwash. Like the secret draftsman in the subway who cannot leave the likeness of a pretty lady without the improvement of mustachios, I have my incurable compulsion. This is to read all that's set before me. Painted or printed, I am a pushover for every single word. But there are compensations. In a pool hall in the Roseland building on Broadway the other night, for instance, hard by the cash register, I found this text, hand-lettered and hung pointedly over a fat tabby cat. "I know you enjoy to pet me, but please do not do this, as I have to get my sleep." Then there were the three gentlemen of the Navy who needed their slumber even more than the poolroom cat and who were taking it even more enthusiastically at 4 a.m. on the winter pavement. This was Broadway again, in front of a movie palace, and the sight would have lost its meaning if my sign-reading compulsion had not spelled out the words for me on the one sheet above the three sleeping sailors. It said, "Lost Weekend." On the Great White Way, a couple of orange huts have changed hands, and the Winter Garden has abandoned itself like an old frump to movies, and British movies at that. But Broadway hasn't changed much in a year. It never does. Swifty Morgan is wintering in the South. I found him in Florida 2 weeks ago behind a beard. It's new and real and quite certainly the unloveliest thing to be seen nowadays at Hialeah. But such among the local citizenry who get their sunshine from John the Barber and who take a poor view of palm trees unless they're helping keep the Copacabana roof over Monte Prosser's head are much in evidence at the old stands. Even Winchell, fearful of what a strike can do to a wire, came back in a flash from his winter palace in the Rhone and is holding Levy again at the big table by the door in the cub room of the Stork. In the Schubert Alley precinct, however, I looked in vain for Phil Gannon and his horse. Phil was a mounted policeman, and his horse, named whimsically enough Rover, was almost as warm a friend to one and all as the big Irishman who rode him. Phil, the boys told me, is retired. Nobody knows what cop has Rover today. Even Phil doesn't know. The day he left the force, he just checked in his uniform and equipment and left quietly by a side door of the station without shaking hands all around according to custom or even a goodbye. Somebody who ran into him a few weeks ago reports that Phil has lost a lot of weight and taken on a lot of years. He misses Rover. Seems he left the way he did, abruptly and all by himself, because he didn't want to know who was going to get Rover, and he didn't want the boys to see how much it meant to him. But everything, as I say, is just about the way I left it. The 21 Club has enlarged itself, and I found George G. Nathan where I left him, in the same old southeast corner. We had a couple of the same together, during which I learned that H.L. Mencken has managed to introduce a new beer to that greatest and most conservative of all beer stubes, Luchow's, on 14th Street. We made a date to sample it together. Concerning saloons, George tells me that America's greatest playwright, Eugene O'Neill, who George says has just written his greatest play, is opening a pub out on Long Island, thus realizing a lifelong ambition. Of course, it'll be near the sea, and Nathan has named it for him the High Dive. Up to this last week, there was one reservation for next New Year's. Theodore Dreiser's death canceled it. I put my name up in his place, but of course, no man can ever take Dreiser's place except in a saloon, and I'm not so sure about that. Concerning saloons, the good word is that the most celebrated of all saloon keepers, Mr. Toot Shore, is, as ever, untouched by his own huge personal and professional success. If the Stork is the Mermaid Tavern of New York, Toot Shore's is the Boar's Head, except that here Falstaff is the proprietor. Toots, like Fat Jack himself, is not only witty in himself, but the cause that wit is in other men. I like his jokes about himself best of all. At the opening of Hamlet 2 weeks ago, for instance, it's reported that Toots announced during the intermission that he was the only bum in the audience who was going back for the second act to see how it turned out. And speaking of Shakespeare, I'm reminded of the days when I was playing Falstaff, the original part, in a production which was facing extinction on the road because the Theater Guild had yet to produce Philadelphia Story and Oklahoma, and I was broke. All my radio money had gone to keeping it open. Things were looking pretty black when Toots came up to Philadelphia to see me. Things have been pretty black for Toots, too. For several years, he'd been promoting a restaurant, and there were those around town who said he'd never make it. Now, finally, he'd scraped together a few $1,000s, and with these, he'd hoped to get started. He brought this money with him to Philadelphia. He wanted me to take it for my show. The nearest thing we've ever had to an argument was when I refused. He's that kind of a guy. Well, with that dough Toots wanted to give me, Toots Shore, the cafe on 51st Street, was built and ready to open its doors, and Toots Shore, the impresario, shaved carefully and put on his last good suit. Baby helped him pick the right tie, and before leaving for work, Toots went to the phone to call up his head captain. It was early, but maybe they'd already had some customers. He couldn't find out. The telephone bill was disconnected for non-payment. Toots had exactly a dime in his pocket, but he didn't feel like changing it, so he didn't call at the corner drugstore, and he walked to work. When he got to his new restaurant, the rope was already up. The tables were all full. Toots had a lot of friends. He'll never lose any of them. The rope will never go down. Well, it's said that the Army is preparing to spend $3 million to advertise how pleasant it is to be in the Army. This week, 4,000 soldiers on Luzon held a mass meeting and voted funds from their paltry GI incomes for full-page advertisements in 15 United States daily newspapers to tell the public what they think of peacetime military service. Although the money GIs can raise for advertising won't compare with any $3 million taken from taxpayers for publicity by the brass hats, senators and congressmen know that returning GIs carry votes in their pockets. Guess which ads will impress them the most, and guess which ads will impress the young men the Army would like to persuade to enlist. Yank, the enlisted man's magazine, makes this comment. "We're even willing to give the Army," says Yank, "for free, without even a 15% commission, some advice on how to make itself more appealing to recruits, how to keep the voting public happy about it, and how to save a few millions of dollars in advertising." Yank suggests more promotion from the ranks and advises that promotions be made on competitive examinations rather than on the well-known process of bucking for rank. Making promotion from the ranks easier would naturally attract better material to recruitment offices and prevent the growing officer caste kind of thinking which led Germany into its 130-year cycle of wars, two of which we'll never forget. West Pointers should put in a year as non-commissioned officers before they get their lieutenant bars, says Yank, and also qualifications of political appointees should be made public. Regarding seniority, Yank says there's no evidence that hardening of the arteries, even in colonels, is an infallible index of brain power. Yank recommends giving GIs the same quality of equipment and housing that officers enjoy. Yank says there's been no single cause of GI hatred for officers greater than the hatred stirred by looking out of a matchbox barracks or a dust-ridden tent to see your platoon commander breezing off to a soft bed in officers' quarters or a quick one before dinner at the chrome and plastic bar of a movie-type officers' club. Yank says, "We believe that improvement within the Army is just 3 million times as important as publicity outside the Army." Well, now, I promised you something about free radios, and I promise you I haven't forgot that opening pitch. We're really giving them away. But first, your attention, please, for an interesting announcement.
When you set out to pick your new radio, you have a right to expect it to have all the worthwhile new things that have come to radio during recent years. You want it to be a set far ahead of anything pre-war years had to offer. When you see and hear the new Lear radios, you'll know in a minute that they give you the newest advances the radio world offers. And right at the start, these radios will have the distinct advantage of Lear's habit of making only the best. Whatever is good and new that will make your radio better, Lear sets will have. In addition to the new Lear sound on tape, some of the sets have television, some an entirely new remote tuning control that lets you tune any station on the dial without getting out of your chair. And there'll be FM and shortwave. As to prices, that's good news, too. The beautiful console radio phonograph combination that gives you everything costs about $500. Then there's the competent, good-looking model for your table that runs about $19.95. But no matter what you pay for a Lear, you can be sure of this, that you get sound radio engineering, latest features, rock-ribbed quality, and the promise of the fullest satisfaction in a radio made by Lear. L-E-A-R. Now back to Orson Welles, whose views and opinions are his own and do not necessarily represent those of Lear Incorporated.
Good friends of the Democratic persuasion, I don't have to tell you that a fascist gift is always a fraud. The Argentine government recently won some strong-handed applause from some weak-minded Americans when it announced an outright gift of 100,000 tons of wheat to starving Italy. I had a hunch there was something phony about this grand gesture, so I checked, and it turns out that Argentina has the wheat all right, but that it'll only give it to Italy on certain conditions, the conditions being that we supply Argentina with trucks, freight cars, gasoline, oil, and lubricants, so that they can carry the wheat to their ports. If we do not supply fascist-dominated Argentina with these sinews of war, they won't keep their promise to give Italy wheat. Well, a little earlier, I said I was going to give away some radios on this program, and unlike the Argentine government, I haven't got any conditions. These radios are made by Lear. They're the five-tube table model, and I've got one for you. If you've got a letter from me, I can use on the show. I need your letters, and I think you could use the radio. I know you'll like it when you see it. Sounds like a fair trade to me. Let's hear from you. And I've been getting a lot of letters about this attack on fortune-telling. And I've been launching. Here's a challenge. If anybody can give me a prediction which I cannot duplicate, or in any way demonstrate the reality of fortune-telling as something real in the scientific world, I'll give them a Lear television model. That's all for that. My time's up. Let me come to call next week, and thanks for this time. Till then, speaking for my sponsors, the makers of Lear Radio, and for myself, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
This is the American Broadcasting Company.